And Steve was most excited. There were probably 20 dogs in the kennel, and you could hear Steve above all the rest of the dogs. So he was happy and jumping around, and he knew where the door was and wanted out of there as quickly as possible and into the car. So, and then he's been awfully clingy since. He thinks we're going to take him back. So anyway, if you want to make your dog behave, take him to the kennel for a while, and then he'll probably knock off some of the stuff that he does. But it has been nice to be back home. It's nice to go to the feast and enjoy that, but it is nice to be home. And the sad part of it is, as you come back and you have beautiful weather, you're still reminded that you live in the world. We do live in Babylon, and it's still here, and we're still part of it, and live in it. We may not be part of it, but we do live in it. In 1969, a Stanford University psychologist named Philip Zimbardo set up an experiment. He arranged for two cars to be abandoned. One of the cars was abandoned on the mean streets of Brooklyn. So they left the car there. They raised the hood and left it unlocked and walked away. The other car was placed in Palo Alto, where Stanford University is located. As I said, the license plate had been removed. The hoods were left open. And this particular fellow wanted to see what would happen. So in the Bronx, he soon found out. 10 minutes after the car was abandoned, people began stealing parts from it. Within 3 days, the car was stripped. And when there was nothing left to take, people smashed the windows and ripped out the upholstery until the car was completely trashed. In Palo Alto, something quite different happened. Nothing. Nothing happened. For more than a week, the car sat there unmolested. Zimbardo was puzzled, but he had a hunch about human nature. And to test it, he went out, and in full view of everyone, he took a sledgehammer and banged part of the car. And soon, passers-by were taking turns with the sledgehammer, delivering blow after satisfied blow. And within a few hours, the car was resting on its roof, demolished. This study provides curious insight into human nature, and scholars and sociologists have used the findings to focus on the loss of civility within a group, culture, or society. It's now called the broken window theory on crime, and the broken window theory states that when a window in a building is left unrepaired, the rest of the windows will soon be broken. Something you might notice: if there's a building, a school, or something like that that's abandoned, and once that first window is broken, how long is it thereafter that all the rest of those windows are broken? The reason is that a broken window sends a signal that no one is in charge, or the standards here are lower, and there will be no undesirable consequences for breaking windows or for other negative actions. Sociologists and law enforcement officials have used what was learned here and applied it to our cities and streets, noting that cracking down on graffiti lowers the incidence of vandalism and more serious crimes. For instance, when Rudy Giuliani became the mayor of the city of New York, crime in the streets was rampant in New York City. And he had been a prosecuting attorney there, and he decided to crack down on the crime. So what were the – they did two basic things. One of the basic things was and you see graffiti in Spain, and you see graffiti even in Portugal on all the subways and all that kind of thing. It's all over. And it's become a worldwide thing where people deface monuments and other things. But what Rudy Giuliani and the people he worked with decided to do is, any time that a subway car had any graffiti on it, it was immediately pulled. And they cleaned that car off, and it did not go back out to the subway until it was cleaned off. And it didn't matter if there was just one little mark on there. They took it off, and they cleaned it. And they did not allow any subway car to go out unless it was cleaned off. Another problem that indicated the lawlessness in the streets of New York was people jumping the turnstiles at the subway. So rather than paying their fares, they would jump over and get a free fare. So what they did is they put police at all of the subway stations, and if you jumped, they caught you, and they had a processing center right there, and you were immediately processed. They got your information, and you know what? They stopped jumping the turnstiles. And once people knew they're not going to put up with the graffiti, they stopped it. And New York became, and just those two things helped to improve conditions on the street of New York. People began to know that there is a standard and they won't allow it to be violated. So it was interesting just taking these two steps, how much of an impact it had on the city of New York. And there is an application for us in the Church of God as well that I'd like to explore. I'd like to explore some of the ramifications of the broken window theory to see how it can and does affect our Christianity and our relationship with God. So where this information was available in a free publication from Hillsdale College called Imprimis. Every Hillsdale College, if I had a place to send my kids, I would have preferred they go to Hillsdale College rather than Ohio State University. It receives no government money, and so they basically are able to do what they wish to do. So they teach many values that we would agree with as far as a university is concerned, and the kids receive a good liberal arts education, which is the type of education that Ambassador College tried to instill. But anyway, the individual who was speaking at Hillsdale, his name was Edwin Fulner, and he was the president of the Heritage Foundation, which is a conservative Washington think tank. And what I quoted here about that experiment, the broken window experiment, was given at a commencement address in 2004. In his speech, he goes on to take this theory and apply it not only to street crime, but to incivility in general. He speaks about incivility in human relationships, in neighborhoods, in the workplace, in politics, noting how incivility spreads. Another way of saying it is that everything sinks to the lowest common denominator. Human nature always goes to the lowest thing you will accept. And that's how human nature is. It will always go, if it's this low, it'll go that low. If it goes lower, it'll go to everybody else will go along with it, it seems. Consider some of the areas in which we see this principle at work. Look at the political process. The more willing one candidate is to sling mud, the more the other fires back, and it gets progressively worse. Yesterday, one statement was made that one of the individuals running for governor in California, they likened the person to a harlot. They used a different word. Harlot's more old-fashioned, so we can accept it more. But once that starts, it just goes back and forth with human nature. Look at TVs and movies. Since shock values gain viewers and thereby advertising revenue each season, producers have to do more and more using graphic violence, sex, and language. And once the barrier of what is considered civil or decent is broken, everyone else jumps on board and follows suit. If you watch TV, think about Ozzie and Harriet, think about the Beaver, and think about what's on there today. Just think about it. You never heard those certain words that you hear today quite commonly expressed back then. They didn't discuss those subjects. You would never see homosexuality portrayed, would you? It wouldn't happen. I mean, if you go back far enough, you have Clark Gable and another woman, I forget the name of the movie, but they were in separate beds, and for years you had them in separate beds. You couldn't even portray that. And we would think, boy, that's so naive. Well, that wasn't all bad. The Internet is also a study in the action of this principle. Mr. Fulner talks about chat rooms where one person begins to wield the hammer and incivility starts. In short order, I mean, if you look at an article, for instance, and you start looking at what follows the comments, sometimes the comments are as interesting as the article. And people going back and forth and making comments about each other, it's you know, interesting how sometimes it devolves very quickly into a lot of incivil comments. So once one person starts making negative comments, other people jump on board, and the war of words, the incivility begins. I don't spend a lot of time on chat rooms or any of that kind of thing, but the little bit that I've looked at it, I do make note of that. Let's go to Proverbs chapter 29, look at verse 18. A foundational principle that's important to all of us, Proverbs chapter 29, verse 18. In the King James Version, it says, "Where there is no vision, the people perish." But the more accurate translation is found in the New King James. It fits more accurately with the wording in the Hebrew. And it says, "Where there is no revelation." Where there is no revelation. Where does revelation come from? Revelation comes from God. Revelation comes from God. In fact, we're going to be talking about revelation, not the book of Revelation, but that particular subject in a way that I think you'll find interesting next Sabbath. Where there is no revelation, the people cast off restraint. But happy is he who keeps the law. Happy is he who keeps the law. So where God's law is a revelation, and where that revelation is your guide, you have vision as to how to conduct yourself and how to deal with other people. But where there is no revelation, where you don't accept that revelation, there is no restraint. What is there to restrain you? What is there to restrain you? Without people teaching or upholding the standards, restraint is cast off. And when people see what amounts to a broken window, they begin breaking out windows too. When the signal is given to smash the laws of God, a kind of mob mentality takes over. Just a personal example. When I was in junior high school, we used to go to lunch, and so we would all be standing around after lunch. And, you know, junior high schoolers never get into trouble. But we did. It's amazing, but we did. So anyway, we're all standing there, and you had a group of kids that was going to class inside the building and another group of kids that was going to PE. So what happened was, and you also had a teacher who was walking around the area there, and he was to kind of keep control. So they had one teacher doing this, and his name was Clyde. You know, so he had a pair of sunglasses on, and he walked around, "Hey, you." And so anyway, he would nail the kids, and we'd get to go see the principal and all that kind of thing. So anyway, I was a pretty good kid, and I would watch what is unfolding here. So there were these berries on these bushes. And I forget whether it was the PE people or the people going to class. They started throwing some berries. And then the people started throwing berries back. And more people started joining in, and pretty soon you had a war with these berries going back and forth between these two groups of people. So I'm watching this and thinking, well, this is kind of neat. So what do I do? Joining the crowd, I started throwing berries. I threw one handful, and the next thing I knew, Clyde had me, and I was going to the principal. And I'm thinking, I threw one handful, and here I go. Probably God knew, don't let this guy throw more than two because he'll be off the deep end and we'll never get him back. But anyway, that's how it is. And if you've ever been around something like that, you'll find people will join in like that. If you've ever seen riots, you'll have people that the day before, nobody was breaking out the windows in a store and stealing TVs or anything like that. But once order breaks down, what do? They're all knocking the windows out and throwing stuff, and everybody in their neighborhood is grabbing a TV or a radio or, you know, whatever it may be and taking it. And then the next day you go back and everybody's kind of going in an orderly fashion. But people jump on board pretty quickly. That's how it is with human beings. So when the signal is given to smash the laws of God, a kind of mob mentality takes over. Let's look at an example in 2 Chronicles chapter 28. This individual was a ruler in the kingdom of Judah. 2 Chronicles chapter 28. And interestingly, he was a his father and grandfather were actually good kings. But whatever the grandfather and the father did, it really didn't impact him. His grandfather was Uzziah, who was a good king, and Jotham was a good king. But this particular king, by the name of Ahaz, did not do what was right. And let's look here at verse chapter 28, verse 19. 2 Chronicles chapter 28, verse 19. And he very negatively impacted his nation. Verse 19 says, "For the Lord brought Judah low because Ahaz, king of Israel, for he had encouraged, by the way that he lived, he had encouraged moral decline in Judah." He encouraged it. He was, you know, he is the king. He is to lead them in a right moral path, but instead he is leading them to moral decline in Judah and had been continually unfaithful to God. It goes on to say here a little later, expresses what he was doing. It says in verse 22, it says, "Now in the time of his distress, King Ahaz became increasingly unfaithful to the Lord." This is King Ahaz. "For he sacrificed to the gods of Damascus, which had defeated him." Should he have been doing that? You know, because he was unfaithful, God didn't bless him, and the Assyrians defeated them. And he began worshiping at their gods, saying, "Because the gods of the king of Syria helped them, I will sacrifice to them that they may help me." But they were the ruin of him and all Israel. So Ahaz gathered the articles of the house of God, cut in pieces the articles of the house of God, shut up the doors of the house of the Lord, and made for himself altars in every corner of Jerusalem. And in every single city of Judah he made high places to burn incense to other gods, and provoked to anger the Lord God of his fathers. Now the rest of his acts and all his ways from first to last, indeed they are written in the book of the kings of Judah and Israel. So Ahaz rested with his fathers, and they buried him in the city in Jerusalem. And they would not bury him in the tombs of the kings because he was so immoral. He was an immoral king, and he led Israel in that immorality. And he went on to practice infanticide, sacrificing his own son, murdering newborns and infants, and burning them alive on the altar of fire. And so this man impacted his people, and people began to follow that. And basically, he brought about a moral breakdown among the people of Judah by his conduct. And what can we conclude from this is that a lack of civility brings about a lack of restraint. If somebody else is uncivil, it leads to other people being uncivil. It helps to break down the restraint and to break down the lack of respect. There is a breakdown in things, and there is a direct correlation. So once, you know, when you think about the way that you conduct yourself, if you show you're uncivil and you show a lack of restraint, you impact others, and you basically encourage others. Well, he's doing it. Why shouldn't I do it too? Let's go to Hosea chapter 4. Let's look at Hosea chapter 4. Hosea chapter 4. And as you look at what it says here, this is a description of ancient Israel, and I think that you can apply what's said here to Israel today. in what is being described as a nation that seems to be almost without restraint. Hosea chapter 4, verse 1. Hear the word of the Lord, you children of Israel, for the Lord brings a charge against the inhabitants of the land. There is no truth or mercy or knowledge of God in the land. You know, truth had basically vacated the land. Think about what's going on in our country today. There is no truth or mercy or knowledge of God in the land. Verse 2, by swearing and lying, killing and stealing and committing adultery, they break all restraint with bloodshed upon bloodshed. Therefore the land will mourn, and everyone who dwells there will waste away. With the beasts of the field and the birds of the air, even the fish of the sea will be taken away. It seems that with each new swing of the hammer, the standards sink to a new low, and everyone else follows. And the dangerous thing for God's people is that we all have human nature, and therefore we are all easily affected by what goes on around us. We're all affected by the decline of civility, the decline in morals and standards. It's part of human nature to take part in the smashing of standards almost without reservation. And that's why we as a church have had to address the subject of moral relativism. Morals are not relative. We believe as a church in absolutes. There is an absolute standard that applies yesterday, today, and forever. And those standards are always absolute. There is no variance in them. It doesn't matter whether you live in the 21st century or the 20th century or the 19th century. They always apply. And just because the world sees everything in relative terms, well, just because he was a cannibal doesn't mean that that's bad. That was good for him. Well, if he's eating you, that's probably not a good thing for you. There's never any, that's never appropriate. But the thing is that we sometimes can feel like it's okay because everybody else is just the way it is. And God said, no, my standards are always the same. They're always the same. Don't ever give in to that. You know, they may be breaking out windows. They may be smashing cars. Whatever they may be doing, don't you join in and do it too. Don't do it. So something we as Christians need to be constantly aware of and be on guard against, lest the broken window theory begin to impact our lives too. It's also important to understand that the broken window theory also impacts our relationships. It impacts our families, our local congregations, and the Church of God in general. And if left unchecked, it will destroy unity and care and love. It will take us from Christians who love and serve others to people who will attack, devour, and destroy one another. And there's a great deal of evidence of that today. People make some rather uncivil comments about other people. And based on what? Based on what? Many times it's based on what they think is true, and they don't know it to be true. And you know, you always have to keep in mind that before you make that uncivil comment, you've got to think about, you know what, that person, how do you know that God's Spirit isn't in them? That they are a potential son or daughter of God. And for you to make that comment about somebody who is ultimately going to be your brother or sister in the kingdom of God, you better really think twice about that. And unfortunately, once you get started in some of these things, you don't think twice about it. And it's pretty easy to do. Marriage is another area where this applies. Marriage isn't easy. It isn't easy, and most couples have challenges in their marriages. And some of those challenges can drive a wedge between spouses if it's allowed to play itself out. If one spouse shares his or her struggles with friends who begin to sympathize and rail against the clod you married, you know, as you share what a rat your husband is. Yeah, that guy is a rat. How could he do that? Or, you know, I'm married to the ice queen. Yeah, she is kind of frigid there, you know. So everybody jumps on board. And it doesn't take much to do it. You get people to agree with you. And then they take your side. And that's where I've told you, don't do that. Don't take sides, especially. We are the body of Christ, and we're taking sides against each other sometimes. Why? In reality, the spouse swung the first hammer blow by not speaking of the other in respect. But once that first blow is landed, it seems it's very easy for friends to jump on board and begin swinging also. So you're kind of like there with the car that's untouched, and you come out there and you take that first hammer blow on that car, and the next thing you know, everybody's, yeah, let me take a shot at that. And everybody else is beating the car up, and pretty soon the car's trashed and on its roof. So that's where you have to be very careful about what you share and the comments that you make about your spouse, your children, other members in the congregation. And it's not just it doesn't carry on just in marriage. It seems it's not hard for people to attack the church, the administration, the ministerial services, or the ministry in general. And that's a sad thing. People don't think twice about making negative comments, and it's a lack of civility. And once the ball gets rolling, dozens, if not hundreds, stand in line to take their shots. If you've availed yourselves of some periodicals, the Journal is the most outstanding example, and shots are going on there all the time. Why would I read that? You have blogs. Everybody has their blog and their opinion. So what? You know, that's not a big deal anymore. You can write a blog, but is it edifying? Is it attacking? You have chat rooms and people just jump on each other and attack each other. You have Facebook and Twitter. I know that on Facebook, if you get onto one particular site and you take a particular position, it seems like there are people just lurking there waiting for you to say something that contradicts their view, and boom, they're on you with both feet, making their comments about you're a liar and you don't know what you're talking about, and you're like, wow, I just was stating my opinion. So that's what we're talking about, and things easily deteriorate. A mob mentality takes over. But interestingly, many comments do not stem from personal experience. A lot of times they're driven by emotion. And human nature wants to join in the attack. Even if you're a Christian, once you get started with this, it's easy to join in. To get your, let me have a shot with that sledge and hit it with the sledgehammer. Within our congregations, gossip and character assassination are clear and present manifestations of this problem. Yeah, did you hear what he did? What a moron. Whatever. And we can attack each other pretty easily. How often in a small group will a juicy tidbit be mentioned, and before long, several in the group have their own stories to tell? And with the first swing of the hammer, the door was open for others to swing as well. Let's go to Isaiah chapter 59. Isaiah chapter 59. Isaiah chapter 59, verse 1. It says, behold, the Lord's hand is not shortened that it cannot save, nor his ear heavy that it cannot hear. But your iniquities have separated you from your God, and your sins have hidden his face from you, so that he will not hear. For your hands are defiled with blood, and your fingers with iniquity. Your lips have spoken lies. Your tongue has muttered perversity. You see, when you begin to swing, you begin to be uncivil. You're swinging the hammer, and the first result is that you are separated from God. It is sin. you are separated from God. And with sin, God is no longer in our midst. We ask Him to be here among us at church services or wherever we are at. And we ask Him to inspire our listening so that we can hear and learn what we need. But how does that work if we're engaged in breaking windows right here in services at sometimes if we're saying things that are negative? We don't want to do that. We don't want to be separated from God. We want to do what is right, and we don't want to be swinging that hammer there and here at services or anywhere where we're with God's people. If you're in the workplace, your boss may not be the best boss in the world, but when you're there talking about the boss with other people, you know, it's pretty easy to start swinging the sledgehammer with the boss, isn't it? Oh, man, who made that decision? It's pretty easy to do. But we're Christians, and we're learning to do that. And it's a challenge to do it, because human nature is just easy to jump in there. It is very easy to jump in there. And I know when I was younger, and it seemed like it was so easy to criticize, so easy to attack and be critical of others. And, being a pastor of a church reminds me of how many errors that you can make, and you don't make them necessarily deliberately. But, you know, it's easy to be attacked and attack others, and so don't do that so much. Let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 24 and look at a bad example and then see how it was corrected. 1 Samuel 24. We see a man, this is an example of a man who is after God's own heart. And he began to swing the hammer in a way. And he set an example for everybody, but he corrects it. Let's go to 1 Samuel 24, beginning in verse 1. Now it happened when Saul had returned from following the Philistines that it was told him, saying, "Take note, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi." Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all Israel and went to seek David and his men on the rocks of the wild goats. So he came to the sheepfolds by the road where there was a cave, and Saul went in to attend to his needs. David and his men were staying in the recesses of the cave. You know, amazingly, here is the king of Israel who's seeking to kill David, and he comes into the very cave David's in. Now, the conclusion you would come to is, oh, God has given me into his hands. I can kill him so easily. You could come to that conclusion. And verse 4, then the men of David said to him, "This is the day of which the Lord said to you, 'Behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hand, that you may do to him as it seems good to you.' And David arose and secretly cut off a corner of Saul's robe." Now, he didn't kill him, but he cut off a corner of his robe. And he did it quietly and stealthily, so Saul didn't know anything about it. So he went ahead and took that action, and but he didn't kill him, but he certainly could have. And then he says in verse 5, "Now it happened afterward that David's heart troubled him because he had cut Saul's robe." You see in the New Testament it talks about your heart being pricked. That's what was happening with David. His heart was being pricked by God's Holy Spirit. So he was troubled by what he had done. He realized that I've overstepped my bounds. I had no right to do this. He in a sense, taken the hammer and used it, wielded it. He realized that he was wrong. And he says in verse 6, "And he said to his men, 'The Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord.'" So he recognized that Saul wasn't a good king, but God had allowed him to be anointed king, to be placed in that position. And he didn't even have the right to cut off a piece of his garment. He had no right to do that. He was overstepping his bounds by doing that. And he felt bad about it, and he corrected it here with his servants. He said, look, I should not have done this. He goes on to, and he said to his men, the Lord forbid that I should do this. And then he says in verse 7, so David restrained his servants with these words and did not allow them to rise against Saul. And Saul got up from the cave and went on his way. So what David recognized was that his servants saw what he was doing. They saw him wield the hammer, and they're all saying, give us a shot too. We'll take our shot. You've done it, so we'll follow your lead. But David recognized what was going to happen, and he said, I shouldn't have done this. My example was wrong, and you shouldn't do it either. And he stopped them. He corrected his actions and did so in such a way that everyone surrounding the event would know without a doubt that this was not an acceptable action. And he goes on to say here in verse 8 that he went to not only correct it with his men, but he also corrected it publicly. David also arose afterward, went out of the cave, and called out to Saul, saying, my lord the king. And when David looked behind him, David stooped with his face to the earth and bowed down. And David said to Saul, why do you listen to the words of men who say, indeed, David seeks your harm? Look, this day your eyes have seen that the Lord delivered you into my hand in the cave, and someone urged me to kill you. But my eye spared you, and I said, I will not stretch out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed. Moreover, my father, see, yes, see the corner of your robe in my hand, for in that I cut off the corner of your robe and did not kill you, know and see that there is neither evil nor rebellion in my hand. And I have not sinned against you, yet you hurt my life to take it. Let the Lord judge between you and me, and let the Lord avenge me on you, but my hand shall not be against you. So he wasn't going to raise his hand against the king. And he realized that he overstepped his bounds, and he corrected it. And after doing so, do you suppose any of David's men would raise their hand against Saul? I don't think so. So what we see here is civility brings about restraint and respect. With these acts, these we act with dignity and honor toward others. We want to show civility toward others, restraint and respect. Let's go to 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2. First Peter chapter 2, verse 13. So what Peter is doing is advocating civility toward constituted authority. First Peter chapter 2, verse 13. It says, therefore, submit yourselves to every ordinance of man, for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme, or to governors, as to those who are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of those who do good. So we are to submit ourselves to every ordinance of man. But what happens if I don't like him? What happens if I don't like his policies? What happens if I don't like his laws? What happens if I don't like whatever it is that those in authority are doing? Now, we shouldn't break God's law, but where we can be submissive and respectful and civil, we should be. And it does not seem to indicate that we can make derogatory comments about them, does it? Now, we can say, I don't like this policy, but we don't have to be personal with it. We don't have to personally attack them. And that's that is inappropriate. Verse 15, for this is the will of God, that by doing good you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. As free, yet not using liberty as a cloak for vice, but as bondservants of God. That's who we are. We are God's servants. We are God's representatives. And when people look at us, they look at how we act. Do we act civilly toward others? Or do we make derogatory comments? And it's pretty easy to do. You know, we're in the midst of the political season, and there are all sorts of derogatory comments, all sorts of cheap shots that are made. And, you know, we live in a country where people are free to express their opinions. And you may disagree with somebody's opinion, but are you going to attack them? You know, think about it. If you, not that we should be political, but let's say you start putting up signs in your front yard supporting one candidate. Could there be possible repercussions to that? Where, well, you're supporting that guy? And, you know, somebody eggs your house or takes your sign down or whatever it may be. That's the world we live in. And that's not the way we, you have your opinion, I have a different opinion, and we can all get along here. So we are free, but we don't want to use our liberty to do things that are inappropriate. It says, honor all people. Honor all people. Well, what happens if I don't like them? It doesn't give you that out. It says, honor all people. You don't have to, respect or build up what they do that's wrong, but you can be, you can be respectful, you can be civil to them. Honor all people, love the brotherhood, that would be the church. Fear God, I think that's pretty fundamental, and honor the king. Honor the king, even a wretched king like Nero, or a wretched king like Ahaz, he is still God's anointed, even though his example was atrocious. So once the hammer has swung, dignity and honor toward others disappears, and it can be quickly replaced with slander and attacks and envy and jealousy and eventually hatred. And, we don't want to participate in that. Let's go look at the right approach here in Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4. You know, when I went to, we were embroiled in conflict within the organization, but you know, when I went to the feast, I didn't hear any of it. And that was great. I was glad. I don't want to hear it. You know, we were well fed spiritually. The people enjoyed one another's company. We had a very fine time. That's how it should be. Ephesians 4, beginning in verse 1, it says, I therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you to walk worthy of the calling with which you were called. We've been called by God. We are his representatives. We are potential members of his family, and we are preparing for that. He says in verse 2, with all lowliness and gentleness. With all lowliness and gentleness. With long suffering, bearing with one another in love. So we've been called by God, and we are to walk worthy of that calling. And we have to ask, if I get my hammer out and I use it, is that an action that is worthy of my calling? Or are we walking with lowliness and gentleness, with long-suffering, bearing with one another in love, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace? Is that the approach that we have? It's the approach that we want. Rather than in destroying a car or breaking out windows, this approach restores dignity and honor by practicing civility, restraint, and respect. As police have found, violent crime in a neighborhood can be curbed by cracking down on graffiti and vandalism. And something as seemingly simple as hopping a turnstile at the subway in order to get on board for free must be dealt with quickly and decisively to transmit the message that's not appropriate and to restore dignity and honor and respect. You look at David's example. That's an example we can all follow, isn't it? You know, you might think about when somebody makes a negative comment to you, whatever it may be, whoever it may be about, why not say, you know, if you're picking up the hammer here and you're beating on the car, maybe you ought to quit doing that. And don't join them. Yeah, let me take a few whacks at that too. You know, when you do, if you would do that, you know what? It would stop a lot of things that go on. We are to be men and women who are not only striving to retrain human nature, but also to yield to God's Spirit working in us. And we have God's Spirit to help us. Finally, let's look at one last scripture in 1 Peter chapter 5. 1 Peter chapter 5. First Peter chapter 5, beginning in verse 1. The elders who are among you, I exhort, I, who am a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, and also a partaker of the glory that will be revealed. He tells those who are elders, shepherd the flock of God which is among you, serving as overseers, not by compulsion, but willingly, not for dishonest gain, but eagerly, nor as being lords over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the crown of glory that does not fade away. So elders are to be examples. Hopefully we can set a good example for all. Likewise, it says, you younger people, submit yourselves to your elders. Imitate them as they imitate Christ. Yes, all of you, be submissive to one another and be clothed with humility. God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. So, you know, brethren, we face a world where people are uncivil. You know, we face it, you know, throughout our day. But even though they're uncivil, we are to be civil. We are to be respectful. We are to be people who build up and who set a good example. Because it's all preparation for the world tomorrow. As members, we're all to treat each other with dignity and respect. We're to be humble. We're not to be beating on the cars. We're not to be breaking out windows. We're not to be maligning and slandering another person. As we've seen in 1969, Philip Zimbardo conducted a social experiment that illustrated a part of our human nature. And, you know, I've been to some neighborhoods with those cars that are abandoned and burned out, and I visited in those neighborhoods. And, you know, you're in that neighborhood and you think twice about being there. I know I wasn't so worried about it, but once I was in such a neighborhood, and my wife said, we shouldn't be here. Because you look around and you're worried. I wasn't so worried because it was daylight and I had been there before, but it didn't look real enticing to be in that place. So what became known as the broken window theory has implications for law enforcement, for social scientists, and frankly for us as members of God's church. If we don't have the civility and respect in our neighborhoods, what do we have? If we don't have civility and respect in our congregations, what do we have? If we don't have civility and respect in our marriages and families, what do we have? At the end of his commencement address, Edwin Fulner had this to say, incivility is not a social blunder to be compared with using the wrong fork. Should I use the little fork or the big fork? It's not that kind of a blunder. Rather, it betrays a defect of character. Incivility is dangerous graffiti, regardless of whether it is spray painted on a subway car or embossed on the title page of a book. The broken windows theory shows us the danger in both cases. Defend your conviction, those virtues, with all the spirit you can. This week it was interesting, a very wealthy man said, we don't need virtue. We need financial stimulus. We need money instead of virtue. He couldn't be more wrong. Money's not our issue. It's a lack of virtue, a lack of civility. Defend your convictions, those virtues, with all the spirit you can, but do it with all the civility that you ought. As you leave this place, this special place, which was Hillsdale College, lay your hammer down. And we should echo the same thoughts. Incivility is a road we must not even begin to travel down. We have the ability to identify the problem, and we have the power of God's Spirit to combat it. So let's learn the lesson of the broken window theory. And next time we're tempted to follow in the steps of those attacking the virtues of civility and restraint and respect, inside or outside the church, I hope we have the humility, the respect, and civility to lay our hammers down.